Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. This is Tim Reedy, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Father Virgilio Elizondo. Welcome, Father.
Good, Tim. It's good to be here.
Now, Father, there's a new book of spiritual writings that has just been published by Orbis. Father Elizondo is a professor at Notre Dame, but also does pastor work in San Antonio. So that's quite a commute that you do on a regular basis.
Well, somebody's got to keep the airlines in business. No, it's, when Notre Dame invited me to teach at Notre Dame, there's a couple of reasons why I had to stay in San Antonio. One was my Archbishop wanted me to continue doing work that I was doing there with our local television station, which I've done a lot of work in. But also at that time, my mother was very ill. So my sister and I were taking care of her. We didn't want to put her in a nursing home. So it was those two reasons that in negotiations with Notre Dame, and the agreement was that I would be a commuter professor, that I would be there during the week, but I would fly back to San Antonio on the weekends. So it works quite well. I'm used to it. And, you know, it's like many other commuters. I have one foot in the academia and one foot in the basic pastoral life of the church. So I consider that a good combination.
Yeah, why is that important to you, to have that kind of grounding in pastoral work?
Well, basically, Tim, I'm a diocesan priest. I'm basically a parish priest. I think that the real church is at the grassroots. I think it's important to look at the structures of the church and ecclesiology and so forth. But when I'm in the parish, listen to confessions, and by the way, they're on the increase, very, very much on the increase.
Oh,
And when I'm there, you know, preaching with the people and just visiting with them about their ordinary struggles of everyday life and so forth, I think that's the grounding of what I've tried to reflect theologically. I think I never really had a vocation to be a theologian. Some people have that vocation. Mine was to be a priest, but as I tried to dig deeper into finding meaning in the life and struggles of the people, especially the Mexican American people, but really of any human being, you know. And so as I tried to dig deeper into what was the Christian meaning of what was happening and of what maybe should happen, I started to dig deeper and deeper, and that's why I gradually found myself doing theological work.
Now, this new book by Orbis attests that you are, as it says, the founder of U.S. Latino theology, which, I mean, that's quite a role, that an important role. And what exactly, maybe you could kind of describe to our listeners, what would you describe as kind of a Latino theology?
I think it's more several factors. I think one is the style of doing theology. I think now is a recognition that all theology is historically and sociologically based. And so the theologian reflects out of that socio-historical reality, which often our European, North American theologians don't consciously reflect on it because they take it for granted. So they simply say we're doing theology. I think one of the characteristics of Hispanic theology, they're very conscious of our socio-historical reality. And it's out of that perspective, out of that defined perspective, that we try to search the scriptures for meaning. So I think one characteristic would be certainly the methodology, that it begins always with a faith experience. It doesn't begin with Plato, Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, Bonaventure, although we take them seriously. We don't ignore them. But we begin with the living faith experience of the people in the social historical context. And from there, ask the questions, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be a Christian? Where are we? Where are we going? So I think that's a characteristic. I think secondly, another characteristic of Latino theology is that the origins of Latin American Catholicism were quite different than the origins of North American Catholicism. And even though we have the same seven sacraments, we have the Pope, we have the bishops, the basics we have the same, but the way we express our Catholicity is quite different because of our origins. U.S. Catholicism was born basically out of the post-Reformation reforms of immigrant groups that came in and so brought their church with them. That's why the origins of U.S. Catholicism, almost all the parishioners were ethnic, Hungarian, Polish, German, Irish, and so forth. In Latin America, there was a massive evangelization process. There was really a blending of the pre-Reformation Catholicism of Europe with the deeply religious traditions of the Native American people. And that gave the uniqueness to what we call today Latin American Catholicism. Some people that don't understand it look down upon it as being syncretistic, but in reality it's a very rich blend of the religious ethos of two peoples to form something new. And And that is the reality of Latin American Catholicism. It's out of that reality that we reflect theologically. A reality which Pope Benedict, when he went to the Aparecida meeting of Latin American bishops, called the great treasure of Latin American Catholicism. So it's out of that reality, out of those concepts, that we have tried to dig into what is the meaning of our Latin American Catholic expressions of the faith in the United States.
Now, maybe we can talk a little specific here, in particular about Our Lady of Guadalupe. You talk about the traditions of the Latino church, and specifically the Mexican and Mexican-American church. Obviously, you know, people in this country are familiar with the story of Our Lady of Guadalupe, but maybe you could talk about the meaning and how important this is to the Latino community.
Well, Tim, I think, you know, it's certainly important to the Mexican people, but I think sort of it's going beyond the Mexican reality. And people are seeing a very profound sense of meaning for the Americas. That's why Pope John Paul II, at the request of the bishops of the hemisphere, Canada, U.S., Caribbean, Latin America, named her Mother of America, mainly the hemisphere, not just the USA. So I think the origins of Our Lady of Guadalupe are very, very interesting. She appeared before there were any political borders. She appeared only 10 years after the military conquest of Mexico. It probably was the most painful years of the conquered people. She appeared in the very sacred side of the Americas. Tepeyac was a sanctuary of the female aspect of the deity called Tonantzin. So it was kind of, and she kind of offers new hope at a time when the local natives had a collective death wish. So I think she's really, in many ways, a resurrection sign. Many of the early theologians in the 1600s, 1700s, not so much focused on her as a Marian apparition, but they saw her as a major event in salvation history, in the bringing about the two great religions to form something new. And that's why in one of my books, I call her Mother of the New Creation. So I think she brings healing, she brings unity, she brings a sense of dignity to the downtrodden, she gives a sense of hope to those who cease having even a desire to live. She brings a sense of accompaniment. I will be with you. You have nothing to fear. So there's a lot of factors in Guadalupe. And when you canvass people, ordinary people, simply have a devotion to her, it's amazing the variety of the answers they give you. My favorite is a lady on the street answered Jeanette Rodriguez, who's doing research in this and has published some good books on Our Lady of Guadalupe. And she asked her in Spanish, why is Guadalupe so important for you? And she looked at her, and she simply answered with two words. I'll say them in Spanish first. Se quedó. She stayed. Hmm. You know, and I think that's so profound that she sort of is not just present in their sanctuary, Tepeyac, Mexico City, but she seems to be with the people. I'll give you another quick example. When the first Iraq war happened, I had a couple of soldiers, men and a woman, came to me. They've been deployed to Iraq, and they want me to bless their Guadalupe tattoos. Well, I had never blessed a tattoo before, and I kind of, you know, said, you know, wouldn't you want me to bless a medal? I'd be glad to give you a beautiful medal or something. And they looked at me now with a kind of how stupid can you be look, you know, and says, Father, says, we might lose the medal. We don't want to lose her. Mm. So at that time, I blessed my first tattoos, you know. So I think it's that sense of the people that that she's some sort of a mediator with the divine, some sort of a real maternal, protective, loving presence that I try to understand what's important. It's not my explanations that make it important. I always tell people that I simply try to understand something that I find to be growing in importance throughout the hemisphere. There's a lot of devotion to Our Lady of Guadalupe in Canada now, in places throughout the United States, in Latin America. So I try, in my writings, I try to dig into something, not to make it important, but try to understand it because it is important.
What's interesting, you mentioned that she appeared, Our Lady of Guadalupe, before there were borders. And now, of course, in our political context, there's a lot of talk about borders. And Mexican Americans or Mexicans who are immigrants are often looked, you know, with some suspicion by people who live in this country. Do you think there's something in the Catholic tradition, and specifically the story of Our Lady of Guadalupe, that can kind of help at least Catholics get beyond this suspicion?
I think certainly, you know, Christianity is always about the future. A future that in some way has begun in us, but it's not yet complete. Technical word, eschatology, but that's a big word for a very simple thing. Something new that has started in us, but it's not yet complete. I really think my own interpretation, and I say it's my interpretation, that the temple Our Lady asked to be built because temple for the native people meant a way of life. It did not just mean a physical building. So I really think that the temple she has, a home for all the peoples of this land. I really think the home she was asking for, the temple she was asking for, was a hemisphere without borders. I know people say, well, how would you get it done? I don't know. Will it be done my lifetime? No. But I think we can dream and hope, as the prophets of the Old Testament dream and hope for a new heaven and a new earth. And I do feel that the borders are humanly created. They're artificial barriers of division. I do think that if this is going to be a real new world, it would be a world that wasn't divided by ethnic hatreds as the old world has been, by ethnic battles and hatreds and divisions and prejudices. But there could be a new land of diversity. Already, most of our Latin America and the United States are areas of huge diversity. I don't think you find a more diverse country than the U.S. I mean, in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, I understand Mass is celebrated every Sunday in somewhere between 40 and 70 languages in one diocese, you know. And so I think in a way, this is the real new world. Yes, it's going through a lot of suffering and pain. And I think Our Lady of Guadalupe is that mother of all the inhabitants. And nothing brings people together more than mother. And within one family, there's a lot of diversity. So within the American hemispheric family, I think our diversity could be, if we do look at it positively, a blessing. And rather than fearing each other, kind of being excited how the differences can enrich each other. Just look at it at a very gutsy level. We all enjoy ethnic foods. It'd be pretty boring if we had only one type of food. But we all enjoy, you know, eating tacos sometimes, spaghetti some other times, Polish sausage some other time. And it makes life richer. Music's the same way. And so I think if we could develop a spirituality of diversity, and I think that's where Our Lady of Guadalupe gives us an open to, which is basically, as I understand it, Tim, is basically what Jesus is proclaiming as the kingdom of God. A new space where rejection of others would be rejected and all would be welcomed. And I think that's, to me, the goal of Christianity, and it's an ongoing goal. I understand natural fears. People are afraid to lose their security. They're afraid to lose their space. They're afraid to lose their I understand human fears. They're very real. But I think that's where the Christian spirit helps us go beyond those fears. And I think, again, going back to Guadalupe, she said, you have nothing to fear. Am I not here who am your mother? Often a mother tells the kids, don't be afraid, I'm here, you know. And so I think that's the role of Our Lady, is to bring unity to the hemisphere. It won't happen overnight. It won't happen tomorrow. But I think that's a dream that united or reinterpreted through our basic Christian dream of the kingdom of God can be a beautiful goal to keep striving for. You know, it took Europe many, many centuries of useless wars, in a way, to be able to build a common Europe. European Union. I hope it doesn't take us that long and that many wars to build a united America that we can hope and pray for. And I think we need to pray for things that are not yet, but hope to be someday. And that's my way. Now, I don't have any immediate answers as to how, but I have a dream.
Now, you write about Our Lady of Guadalupe in the selected writings. You also write about the circumstances of the life of Jesus in Galilee. What is it that you find in the gospel accounts and specifically about the circumstances of Jesus' life that you think speaks to the immigrant experience, but also the experience of the poor in the world today?
Well, I think what's been fascinating me since I was working on my doctoral thesis, and I couldn't find a connection between the socio-historical reality of the people and how to interpret it theologically. And all of a sudden, Tim, the insight came. I don't know if it was through prayer or through conversation, or to research in libraries, or to drinking some good French wine. I don't know exactly where the insight came, but all of a sudden, like the revelation, the importance that Galilee plays in the New Testament. And I had never really looked into it before, you know, and so, but how often Galilee, which is not important at all in the Old Testament, becomes like a key word in the New Testament. The Annunciation takes place in Nazareth of Galilee. Jesus begins his public ministry in Cana of Galilee. His disciples are calling Galilee. They're identified as Galileans. At the end of the Passion narratives, Peter denies Jesus, but he cannot deny he's a Galilean. The resurrected Lord, after resurrection, sends the apostles back to Galilee, where they will see him. It's from Galilee, he sends them to the ends of the earth. So all of this kind of got me to go look into the reality of Galilee. And I was fascinated to find that Galilee was a region that in many ways was a very mixed region. It was a region surrounded by different nationalities. It was a region that had gone through several invasions. So it was a region very much like our own Texas reality. And the Jewish people were mainly the poor people of the land there, often exploited by foreign landowners, and many lived in poverty. Jesus himself was a day worker, and day workers didn't make that much. At least that's what it seems that it was. So all this kind of just really spoke to our reality, that Jesus was constantly away crossing borders. And so the, and then to see that, and then to jump to the Acts of the Apostles, when the Acts of the Apostles, the early church immediately started crossing borders to bring different peoples into the orbit of Christianity. And so to see that Christianity was constantly going beyond the borders of limitation to offer a new reality, a new creation. And so that's where Galilee became so important to me, kind of a text that became basic to my own spirituality and thinking. It's a text that we find in several places, but especially in the first sermon of Peter after the, after Pentecost, where he speaks about the stone rejected by the builders of society has become the cornerstone. So I start to see that Jesus, the Galilean, was probably sociologically speaking a rejected person, or at least a marginal person. And yet, in proclaiming the kingdom, he rejects rejecting anyone. So in a way, he's the one who has suffered rejection, but now sets out to reject rejection, because the kingdom is welcome. Welcome. And he makes a special effort to go out to those that have been rejected by society to come in. He ends up rejected by everyone at the cross, but he rejects no one. Father, forgive them. And kind of the ultimate rejection of Jesus is the way he dies on the cross, in the nakedness of the cross. And yet Jesus dies because he rejected rejection. But in the resurrection and the Pentecost, he brings about this new creation. So that whole notion that people that have suffered marginalization, rejection, have a mission to work that others will not have to suffer what they had suffered. So in a way that they're chosen, but not to be better than others, that they're chosen for a particular mission, and the mission is to create spaces where others would not have to suffer what they had suffered. So I saw the whole Galilean mission of Jesus as giving light to our own struggles for better education, for better participation in the structures of society, better participation in the church itself.
Now, you've been involved in Latino ministry, you know, on the ground level, as you said, for, you know, at least since the 70s, before that, I'm sure. Now, maybe you can give a sense of how it's grown in this country and, you know, what areas there are still, you know, where there is still room for improvement. Yeah. There is still room for the church doing a better job of reaching out to Latinos.
Actually, I'm involved since the 60s, and I was ordained with an archbishop, Archbishop Robert E. Lucy, who was a great champion of civil rights for the African American, for the Latino, for everyone. Archbishop Lucy was a giant prophet of human rights. And so I was ordained a priest by him and very much influenced by him. So actually my entry to Latino ministry, might say, came right with my ordination. I was ordained in 63, right in the midst of the council. So I'm also very much of a council person, because I was ordained right in the midst of the council. But the Latino ministry, you know, in the beginning, I think the issues were kind of easily defined: better educational opportunities, better opportunities within the church itself, which had not promoted Latino vocations at that time, more like music in Spanish, since the council, the vernacular, more preaching in Spanish, the use of our language, the use of our religious traditions, which many of the North American church did not understand or appreciate, our Holy Week traditions, our Guadalupe traditions. We come out of the church that had very festive traditions, and the U.S. church was much more rule-based, duty obligation. We are more festive-based, based on great festivals. And so in the beginning, it was almost, you might say, looking back, you might say it was almost simple. I think as we've moved along, we became aware it'd be much more complex. For example, in the beginning, the immigration issue was not an issue. People came and went easily. It wasn't that difficult. Many of our people had been here way before. Many of our people, at least in Texas, Arizona, and California, were descendants of the original inhabitants. So a lot of the Latino people did not identify with the immigrant reality. They identified more with the conquered and colonized reality, because, as they say, we did not cross the border crossed us. That the first illegal immigrants came from the United States, not the other way around. before. So anyway, that was a reality, and it was almost more easily defined. I think today, first of all, the immigration issue has become a major issue. Secondly, with all the immigration from throughout Latin America, it is not just Puerto Ricans, Cubans, and Mexican Americans. Now we have Colombians, we have Brazilians, we have Uruguayans, we have Haitians, with the Dominican Republic. Now you might say we have the whole Latin America within the United States. Now within a given parish, given neighborhood, you have almost all representation of Latin America. So you cannot really speak of a Latino community, almost as speak of Latino communities. Say in the Miami area, we've always said Miami Cuban, but Miami now has a lot of Nicaraguans, had a lot of Haitians, had a lot from the Dominican Republic. In the Northeast, you have a lot of people from Colombia. And so now there's a complexity now, because each country in Latin America, even though there was a commonality basically of Catholicism and of the mestizo, the mixed race reality, which is basically Latin America, there's also a difference. There's a lot of difference between the Mexican and the Colombian, a lot of difference between the Peruvian and the Chilean, and so forth. And so not only were the regional differences, so I think in many ways the Latino issue becomes more complex. Also, for example, we have a significant number of Latinos now who are extremely successful in the socioeconomic realm. And, you know, they're involved in all the areas of politics and government and business. We have our millionaires and our billionaires. But that's a small fraction. On the other hand, we still have many of our Latinos still living below the poverty level. We still have a very high rate of high school dropout. We still, on a very painful side, have a very high rate of teenage pregnancies. And so there are some real issues, whereas we've come a long way, we have a long way to go. And in a way, the seriousness of the issues become almost more complex and more urgent. I think the Catholic Church is doing a lot, yet in relation to the need, it appears that we're doing very little. And yet when you look at what we're doing, for example, Catholic Charities does a miraculous job in relocating people, in helping people in immigration. Every diocese is working in liturgy, and we have right now the Mexican American Catholic College is filled with seminarians learning Spanish, and it's Latino tradition. So I think the church is doing very well. I think our Spanish-speaking evangelicals and Protestant brothers and sisters are very dynamic also in reaching out and also getting involved in this. For example, the Spanish-speaking evangelicals have been challenging the English-speaking evangelicals to get more socially involved in the social issues. So I think the issue has become more complex. Again, we have a lot more dynamic Protestant evangelical Spanish-speaking communities. So that's also a challenge to Catholicism. Certainly with radio and television, they're very powerfully in there. So I think, Tim, we've come a long way. I'm excited about the things that have happened. I've seen miracles happen since I've started in many ways. On the other hand, when I see the need growing more and more complex, it becomes scary.
Well, finally, maybe we can end by, you're involved in Catholic Television Network down in San Antonio, and we're always thinking about here in terms of, we're a media enterprise, thinking about ways to appeal to a Latino audience. What ways do you think Catholic media, whether it's television, whether it's magazines or websites, can appeal to that audience?
Certainly Catholic radio. Latinos are very much into radio, and I think that the buying power of radio programs seems to be higher even than television. So I would say, how do we get involved in radio? How do we get involved in telespots, for example, that can give a message in 30 seconds? I think nowadays, little tidbits sometimes go much further than long sermons. Advertisers can certainly tell us this. I think we have a lot to learn. I think in Catholicism it would be good to convoke a group of Spanish-speaking advertisers that are Catholic and say, what can we learn from them as to, quote, selling a product, getting our message across. Because I think sometimes we overlook the obvious. That's why I came back to the 30-second spots. I work a lot with advertisers. I've learned a lot from them. I did a lot of work here in New York for CBS for a while when they used to have the religion section. And we did some very beautiful programs. Unfortunately, they closed it down. But I think, Latinos are getting to the internet. So I think what you're doing here in America, maybe to do a test run on the Spanish language. The same thing we're doing right now.
Sure,
to do a test run. You have enough Spanish-speaking Jesuits and people that would be glad to help you with this. I certainly would, and I'm sure many others would, to get some Spanish-speaking, Spanish-language things on the air. So I think Tim, to experiment in different things. I think we're in a moment where media is moving so rapidly, and I think the Holy Fathers have been pushing us to make more use of media. I don't think seminarians have recourse in media that I know of, and yet the Holy Fathers already with, I think even beyond Paul VI was really urging us to find, certainly Benedict has been pushing us to use the media more creatively. So I think any way we can do to getting Hispanics involved in it would be helpful, fun, and exciting.
Well, again, the book that has just been published by Orbis Press is a part of their Spiritual Writings, Modern Spiritual Masters series. And this, again, selections from the writings of Virgilio Elizondo. And we want to thank you very much for taking the time to come by and visit us.
Thank you, Tim. It's a pleasure.
I want to thank you for joining us for the American Magazine podcast. Remind that you can go online this week to check out our weekly video commentary. This week is Kevin Clark. We also have an online film review of the cartoon Despicable Me. And a reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americanmagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.